I'm going to start off by talking about, in a little bit generally, how biology is being automated, in particular, in comparison with how math was automated. So one good starting point to talk about math automation, forgetting about Babbage and all that, was World War II era, where people wanted to integrate missile trajectories and things like that. It was too tough to do with pencil and paper. So they put teams of people with adding machines. Each person had different piece of the calculation, they'd hand up their result to the next one, and it lets you do things that a single computer, as they call these ladies, couldn't do. So people realized that was a good thing, led to the first fully electronic computer, and ENIAC filled the room, tons of vacuum tubes. Even more of a good thing led to the integrated circuit, which has increased by...
I have to challenge that.
Okay.
The first electronic computer was built at Iowa State University by NASA.
You are correct. And you can quibble about the definition of computer and whatnot, but he was definitely a very important player in the early days of automated computation. It's absolutely. Anyway, integrated circuit has allowed you to scale up the automation of computation enormously by many, many orders of magnitude. Purely by that the scale of that automation, we've realized that automated computation is good for more than just solving math problems, and we use it in giving presentations and communicating and writing and many other aspects of modern life. All right, so how about the biological world? So chemistry and biology are very labor-intensive fields, and in fact, it's not unusual today in academic labs to see rooms full of people with beakers pouring one liquid from one to another, and automating biology does often come down to manipulating fluids.
The dress code has gotten worse, though.
It has. That's forward progress. So biologists have seen the virtues of automation, and biological automation as it exists today has enabled things like sequencing the human genome, and the scale is somewhat reminiscent of the vacuum tube computer in which you have these large fluid handling robots that fill vast warehouses, and that sort of sets a limit on the scale of what one can achieve in automation. And so in my group, we spent some time thinking about, you know, what could replace these robots, and is it somewhat analogous to the integrated circuit? Can we borrow some of those concepts and techniques and whatnot? One important difference, however, which I think everyone here is going to appreciate, is that in the electronic case, the basic physics behind how the transistors operate as these things scale from the centimeter scale down to the 100 nanometer scale, that basically hasn't changed at all. It's classical, and same fundamental principles describe how they work. You can get to novel regimes, sort of mesoscopic quantum physics, in very esoteric circumstances in the physics lab, but it hasn't really had any practical impact yet on how one automates computation in the industrial sense. And so through all the wonderful scaling you've seen in the semiconductor industry, this is still the same, whereas in fluidics this situation is quite different for whatever reason. Mother Nature has seen fit to make fluid phenomena scale much more rapidly with length scale. And you can very quickly get into regimes where the fluid behavior is quite different than your macroscopic intuition will tell you. So to sort of summarize the introduction, I'd say we sort of have two views to think about microfluidics. One is this sort of engineering view, and it's all about trying to implement large-scale automation using nanoliter volumes. And we spent a lot of time thinking about that in my group. We've invented some micromechanical valves that seem to be quite powerful tools to accomplish that. I'm not going to describe how they work, but we'll get into some of the results using them later in the talk. If you're interested in the details of the valves, you can check the references. The other point of view is that sort of the science view that you can, by being clever, try to invent microfluidic components that take advantage of novel fluid properties that aren't available at the macro scale to provide some sort of unique capability. And many, many people in the field have been trying to do that, and Todd and I wrote a review, mostly Todd, trying to summarize the literature and all the different ways people have exploited fluid effects to do novel things. So our sort of perspective in the review was to take all the dimensionless numbers we could think of and talk about whether they scaled or not with size and volume and what the consequences were and how people were taking advantage of them. And that's somewhat how I've arranged the talk here. We're going to step through a bunch of different dimensionless numbers and discuss what the sort of implications are as you get to small length scales. Reynolds number is the most famous one. As Bob Austin likes to say, even your mother knows about the Reynolds number now. And it measures the ratio of inertial to viscous forces, and most often crops up in the context of mixing, and how can one achieve effective mixing in small volumes. And there have been many very clever solutions to that problem. Chaotic mixer, hydrodynamic focusing, by just making the length scale. It all boils down to making the length scale small so that diffusion happens rapidly. Hydrodynamic focusing is a very nice one, and we've been involved in making a rotary pump. So I'll just discuss on the next slide an application that combines the chaotic mixer and the rotary pump to accelerate chemical kinetics in DNA microarrays. So these are very powerful tools of biological automation that are used to measure gene expression of many genes in parallel in an organism, and it boils down to making a bunch of spots on a glass slide with DNA molecules and hybridizing fluorescently labeled cDNA or RNA to them. And you want one spot per gene. You've got 30,000 genes in the human organism. That ends up corresponding to a pretty large area, square inches. And so if you ask how long it takes a macromolecule to diffuse across that, it's many, many days. And so these things just don't have enough time to equilibrate. and that limits sensitivity, among other things. And so my student, Jian Liu, designed a chip here with two large chambers. They're connected by channels. And we have the rotary pump set up to circulate the fluid around. And in each channel is a white size Edge-Jarry chaotic mixer to make sure that the fluid becomes well mixed. So we can circulate the molecules around and help them find their mates much more rapidly than if the only process was diffusion. So this is, in some sense, a combination of Reynolds and Peclet number, the experts. But we were able to show that, in fact, by using active mixing, you can enhance signal sensitivity, signal to noise, equilibration time enormously. This is in Angevin Chimie, and perhaps should be coming out very soon. Okay, capillary number. Is the ratio of viscous forces to surface tension forces, and it doesn't really scale with the size of the device in any particular way, but it's something you can manipulate. By making lithographically defined devices, you can control the boundary condition, the shapes of the flows, and you can play all kinds of fun games and get in this regime where if you have two phases, like oil and water, you can form droplets, and there's a lot of interesting phenomena that derives from that. Todd Thorson and my group started playing around with that in the late 90s, and we were one of the very early players in this area, discovered that this Rayleigh instability could generate droplets, and had the idea of trying to use them as chemical nanoreactors. so the basic idea is you have a T-shaped junction with water coming in, oil coming the other way. There's instability that can develop, and droplets bud off. And so you can show very simple scaling arguments that you expect the droplet size to be determined by balance between the Laplace pressure and the shear forces, and that makes certain predictions that all seem to hold true. As we tweaked all the variables, we actually never published this particular part of the work, but we're interested in the original motivation was to use them as little bioreactors. So you combine cells expressing a particular enzyme, fluorescent substrate for that enzyme, and then before they have time to react, butt them off in a little droplet, so they're all compartmentalized and isolated. And that, in fact, works too. This is E. coli expressing the PNV esterase, and the droplets are lighting up with different colors, and if you go through and look in bright field microscopy, the brightness is proportional to the number of bugs in the droplet, 0, 1, 2. And we also discovered that you can get very complex behavior by just changing the geometry of the channels. And so with certain geometries, you have isolated regular droplets, all nice and evenly spaced. You change the geometry of the channel. Instead of being a rectangular cross-section, make it curved, everything else the same. As you start changing the driving pressure on the two channels, you ramp through a very complex set of patterns. And there's some fun physics in there to explore. So this has now become a cottage industry. this droplet generation. Many people have jumped into it. People have jumped into it, shown that there's technological applications, and it's become sort of a really fun little subfield in microfluidics. Okay, another good number to play with is the Weissenberg number. So this is if you have a non-Newtonian fluid, okay, a polymeric solution. It's going to be the product of the intrinsic relaxation time of the polymer with the rate of deformation of the flow. Okay? And it measures sort of the non-Newtonian nature of the fluid, or the sort of amount of energy being put into elastic effect stretching the polymer. And this doesn't really scale with size of your volume that you're playing with. And it's useful as sort of a source of nonlinearities in microfluidic systems. So in the early days, people said microfluidics is trivial because the Reynolds number is low, there's no nonlinearities in the system, so everything is understood about them. That's obviously not true. The capillary number example is one good case of a very complicated nonlinear system. And this is another one here, where as all the inertial nonlinearities go away, the elastic ones remain. And we spent some time, the former postdoc Alex Graceman, trying to understand to what extent these elastic effects could be a proxy for inertial effects. And the reason why we cared about that is something called fluidics. All right, back in the days before it was clear that semiconductors were going to rule control systems, people had worked out that you could make all sorts of analog and digital circuits using inertial properties of fluid flow. You could make amplifiers, flip-flop gates, all kinds of clever stuff, logic. And if you've ever used a pulsating shower head or had a turbocharger in your car, you sort of see the descendants of that technology. Army was interested in it because they wanted to, and the Air Force, because they wanted to make helicopters and such forth that would be resistant to electromagnetic pulses. Okay, and when bombs go off, bad things happen to electronics. And the sort of ultimate fatal flaw in this program was that as you try to miniaturize to make more complicated circuits, your Reynolds number gets low and the nonlinearities you depend on it for the operating principles go away. So they couldn't be miniaturized in the way electronics could. Here's a big rack of, and people had these very elaborate, clever systems. So you could really make circuits of very impressive complexity by stacking up these laminated sheets, and they would flow in one dimension and come up in through holes in another. And it was really kind of clever. So we thought, could we use these elastic effects as a proxy for inertial effects and recover, and use that nonlinearity to recover some of the operating principles behind these devices and make a sort of miniaturized fluidic control system at non-trivial Weissenberg number. So one of the first things Alice did was try to make a constant current source, which he likes to call a flux stabilizer. You could think of it as a nonlinear resistor. The business part is right here, this channel here, where you see you have these curved sections followed by little narrow jets, and that's meant to, the polymer's extended. The rest of the device is measurement apparatus. Alex worked very hard to figure out how to make very careful measurements of what was going on in the device, and we're very proud of them, sort of percent precision with absolute measurements, absolute units, which you'll see in the next graph. And the basic idea is that this channel here is designed to have the same Newtonian resistance as this one, and you can flow solutions of two colors through, and if there's any difference in the pressure drop, this little line will move here, and you can adjust the driving pressures to compensate for it, and so you can make this nice internally compensated measurement, and then you can calibrate pressure for flux and get graphs that look kind of like this. So on this axis is the driving pressure in units of pascals, and on this axis is the flux in units of nanoliters per second, and this is what the device does. So if it was purely Newtonian Stokes flow, you expect to have a constant resistance, right? The pipe has some resistance, and the flux is proportional to pressure. and this is just like an IV curve in electronics, right? If you had a resistor and you have current versus voltage, you'd have Ohm's law in a straight line. Well, that's what you see until you get to the point where the Weissenberg number becomes around 1. And at that point, the harder you push, you're not getting as much flux through the device because the energy you're putting in is being used to extend the polymers and going into that elastic nonlinearity. And so the reason why we say it's a constant current source is if you sit right at this point, okay, if you're driving it with 90 pascals, you can vary the driving pressure enormously, and the flux hardly changes at all. So in electronic terms, you'd be changing the voltage, and the current's not changing at all, so it's a constant current source. And this graph just shows some of the flow patterns. As you crank up the pressure, you can see that it starts out looking nice and linear, then you get these little eddies in here, and complicated things start to happen. So we then wanted to make a fluidic rectifier, and Tesla had actually invented an inertial rectifier many, many years ago, where the idea was that if you push the fluid through in this direction, you get one resistance, and in the other direction, you get another, because in this direction, it was easier for the fluid to come around and resist its own flow. And so, using elastic effects, we're doing something slightly different. It's to have an asymmetric aperture here, okay? So you have this triangle just repeated, and the idea is that the way the fluid, the extensional flows go, is going to be different depending on the direction you're pumping through. So that's the business part of the device, and the little internally compensated measurement is now done in a symmetric way, so we can take the same device and measure flow in both directions without ever having to change, have to take it apart or change anything. Measure it this way, and then change the direction of fluid flow, measure it the other way. And sure enough, there is a difference as you get above white number one, is somewhere around here, and you start to see a difference between the forward and the reverse flux. Okay, and the inset here shows the ratio, and so in fact, it's as high as a factor of two difference at its greatest effect. And this just shows that, in fact, elastic instabilities are not an exact substitute for inertial. So this shows the flow patterns forward and reverse with the acrylamide solution, and this one with pure water. So here we put in the driving pressures, here the Reynolds number, and it turns out that the way the instabilities develop are in the opposite flow sense in the two cases. You see in the forward direction here, you get these symmetric eddies here, and in this case you get these sort of things that wobble around from one to another, whereas going forward, you have a very late onset. In this case, you get an early onset, somewhat in this direction. Okay, the last little fluidic device I'm going to mention is a little digital device. It's a flip-flop that exhibits bistability. And so the idea here is to take two streams and collide them with each other. So, and this is a little confusing. In this picture, it's shown bottom and top, the two flows that collide and they flow out the side, left and right, and the next slide is going to be turned around. But the idea is that because of this narrow channel here, the polymers have been stretched and they want to stay together when they're stretched. So the predominant bit of the flow is going off this way, whereas this one goes that way. Okay, and there's no reason for it to be left versus right, so it's equally happy in the other state, and you can flip it from one to another by putting transient blockages in the channel. Okay. whoops. Missing a slide. That's not good. I accidentally hit the key slide. Okay, so this is a picture of two of the devices. One of which, so you can look at the color output on one side or the other. Or you can actually look at real physical properties like flux and pressure. And in fact, these devices do create different fluxes and pressures depending on which stream it's going where, and having to do with the resistances of these channels. And so you can have well-defined high and low states. So that's the device. This is the, whoops, that's the data. So for the flux device, this shows the difference in flux between the high and the low states. As a function of the input pressure, it actually gets to be pretty significant. It's on an absolute scale. And this shows the pressure differential for the pressure switching device. And the pressures are actually getting to be, you know, sort of almost large enough to actuate valves and be used to control things. Okay, a reasonable fraction of the input pressure. All right, so now I'm going to talk about some devices we made using valves. To grow protein crystals, and we spent quite a bit of time in this area. So protein crystals are useful because If you can get a nice crystal of a protein, you can put it in a synchrotron beam, get X-ray scattering, recover the phase, and actually get these beautiful atomic scale descriptions of what the proteins look like. And that field is called structural biology. It's incredibly important for basic biological purposes because of the way structure and function are intimately linked in proteins. It's very important industrially because drug companies want to know, you know, where their drugs are binding to their targets and how well they're doing. So every major drug company has a structure group. And there are now attempts to automate this field that go under the name structural genomics. In the same way that DNA sequencing has become completely industrialized now, same thing is going on in this field. However, it's still very early, and so it hasn't been totally successful in creating an automation paradigm for structural biology. Over the past several years, a very talented student of my group named Carl Hansen actually developed such an automation paradigm, working in collaboration with Jim Berger at Berkeley. So the upshot of Carl's thesis was three different microfluidic devices that I think sort of paved the way for how to do automated structural biology, and I'm going to kind of walk you through it. What we kind of ended up was realizing that it's very important to have physical information about the protein you want to crystallize. So Carl developed a device to measure the phase behavior of the protein. We call it the formulator because it mixes up different formulations of chemicals and lets you explore phase space in a systematic way while consuming very small amounts of protein. We then used that information to create a rational crystallization screen, put that screen into what we call the free interface diffusion or FID screening device, which takes advantage of a novel fluid property, in fact, to control the nucleation and growth or the crystallization kinetics. So this has to do with Grashof number. And then once you manage to find a sort of condition that looks like it's reasonable, you can optimize around it and then try to grow a larger crystal in what we're calling the diffraction device, which allows you to take the X-ray data without ever having to handle the crystal. You can just punch out a little disk and put that in the synchrotron beam. So just as a sort of reminder how to proteins or any molecule crystallize, it happens by explaining phase behavior. And so if you have sort of the concentration of your molecule plotted on this axis and the concentration of some precipitant, like a salt or a PEG or something like that, plotted on this axis, at low concentrations, everything is happy in the soluble phase. At very high concentrations, it all crashes to the bottom of the test tube in a disordered mess. That's called the precipitated phase. And all the interesting stuff for growing crystals happens on that delicate boundary between those two phases, between soluble and precipitated. And it's generally subdivided into two regimes called labile and metastable. We can get into that later if you're interested. But the point is, knowing exactly where this boundary would be a very powerful tool in trying to create a good crystallization experiment. The general problem with proteins is you never know what's the right precipitant to use. So if you knew what was the right thing to use on this axis, you could make a few measurements and sort of work out the right phase diagram, but you never know what the right thing is here. So there's many, many hundreds of possibilities, and just are reduced to sort of doing brute force experiments, and it's too expensive in terms of sample consumption to actually measure phase diagram for every reagent. People tend to do just one experiment per reagent and kind of throw a dart and hope that they're going to get lucky. That's one of the reasons why it's very painful. So the formulator, the idea is to measure the phase diagram, because if you can do that by consuming nanoliters of fluid, it's not very expensive in terms of sample. So, and you can go march through many, many reagents. So we have what we call the formulator. This is the mass diagram for the chip. The basic idea, I'll show you a little movie on the next slide. There's a ring here where you mix stuff up. And then there's 33 different inputs. What we tend to do is use 16 of them for different salts and detergents and pegs. Another 16 to control pH with different buffers. And the last one we use to inject the protein, and that goes right into the ring. So all this plumbing is set up to mix up an arbitrary recipe of these guys, and you shoot in a little bit of protein. So you give the computer a list of recipes in a spreadsheet and just mixes them up one by one. And this little movie shows what it can do with food dye. This is real time, and it makes use of the rotary mixing I mentioned earlier. So this is diluting red and blue in water, and in a minute we'll do a more complicated recipe that mixes several things together and then injects a little bit of yellow dye or was in the protein. So Carl spent a lot of time engineering. engineering this device. This is probably as well as the valves have ever performed. We think it's probably the most precise fluid metering device ever made. It's completely insensitive to the properties of the fluid, pH, ionic content, even viscosity over nearly 3 orders of magnitude. And the injection error, the error in metering is a few hundred, 500 femtoliters per injection, so it's just. Yeah, contamination tends not to be a problem because it's just salts and things like that that wash out. The protein you can resolubilize usually. The biggest problem we have with the device is if you're working with a very concentrated protein solution that's unstable, it can crash out and start to clog the channels. And we're working on ways around that. But that's the biggest issue one has. So the way we use the device is start by doing a sparse screen. So you crank through, in this case, 1,000 different chemical conditions at 5 different protein concentrations each, and you just look for precipitation in the ring. The computer is set up to image the ring. By analyzing the image automatically, it spits out a number that is, in some sense, proportional to the amount of precipitate in the ring. And so each of these is a different chemical condition, and where these go spike up, there's a lot of precipitation in the ring. Okay? So those identify conditions where there's non-trivial phase behavior. You can make a precipitate. The different colors here show different runs on different days, different devices, to give you an idea of the repeatability. So what one then does is pick out these conditions that look most promising and measure a full phase diagram there. So with xylanase, that was xylanase you saw there, we picked 24 of those peaks, measured full phase diagrams. So this is precipitated, this is soluble, and this is exactly where you want to do your experiments. Okay. In many of these, we actually went back and did microliter scale experiments as well to see if there was any concordance between what you measure on the chip and what you measure on the benchtop, which is looking for precipitate. And that's the difference between the blue and the red symbols here. So you can see there's a little bit of disagreement along the line, but really they track quite well. So with these phase diagrams in hand, Carl designed a screen for xylanase crystallization and compared it to the commercially available random screens, and there was something like a 72-fold increase in sort of enrichment of successful conditions or probability of success. And in fact, they weren't just minor hits. Many of them were fully formed, beautiful crystals, and it really seemed to pay off. So that's true for xylanase. One of the difficulties in structural biology is that every protein is different, and what you know about one doesn't translate to the next. That's why there's no universal crystallization conditions. And so it's reasonable to ask, was this a fluke, or is it going to be generally useful? So Megan Anderson, who's a young student in the group, took the formulator, and when we published the paper, people started emailing us and asking, could you look at our proteins? And we picked a bunch of very challenging things, several of which never had crystals or structures, almost all of which never had crystals or structures before. And Megan just put them through the device. She measured the phase behavior, create the rational screens, and in 8 out of the 10 cases, she was able to get crystals to grow. So, that makes 9 out of 11 if you include xylanase, and do we feel that, in fact, this looks like it is going to be a sort of robust strategy for finding crystallization conditions. So, how do you best grow crystals? Once you're sort of close in parameter space, how can you grow the most highly ordered crystals?
Yes, the truth that didn't work. Did they that you found the sort of phase boundary, but it just didn't.
Couldn't get crystals.
So the phase boundary.
Yeah, you can always find. You can always make things come out of solution.
But you have no idea really why it didn't.
Yeah, no.
I mean, it's possible that they just don't crystallize at all.
It's possible they don't. It's possible that they were too. It's too heterogeneous a solution. There's contamination. It's possible it's just too floppy on the ends to. So if you're trying to grow good crystals, it turns out one of the relevant dimensionless numbers is the Grashof number, which is a close cousin of the Reynolds number. Grashof is the ratio of buoyant forces to viscous forces, and it measures the importance of convection in some sense. And it scales very strongly with the size of the test tube. So convection is your enemy for a lot of reasons when you're trying to grow crystals. And that's sort of the justification for NASA to grow crystals in microgravity. You see the Grashof number also depends on G. So one way to get it small is to go to a space that's very expensive and it's hard to set up 1,000 experiments. So they really haven't had a lot of impact in the structural biology community. On Earth, you can just go to very small volumes and get the same kind of benefit. So this is sort of three experiments in what's called the free interface diffusion geometry, where you fill one side with protein, little reactors, the other side with your precipitant, have valves to separate them. And then when you open the valves, you have purely diffusive mixing that interface, the free interface diffusion, that's the name of the scheme. And I can tell you why that's interesting. I don't know if I put in a picture of the phase diagram. This is a movie that's not going to work because I blew the link. Well, this was supposed to show you how these chambers get filled. It's, again, food coloring and water. Not a big deal. So it's three experiments. And the one nice thing about this is that this method of metering the fluids is, again, totally independent of the physical properties of the fluid. Because all you're doing is filling a volume here. And that's very important because in this game, you're playing with many different kinds of reagents, all with different viscosities, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. and so the volume is defined by the chamber. This is three different mixing ratios. Yeah. All right. So now, this is the device that Carl came up with. That little motif you saw of three experiments is repeated 48 times. So you've got 144 experiments on the device. And now we're starting to see some engineering economies of scale and how it works. There's a single point here where you fill it with your protein, and by putting in just a couple of microliters of protein, you're able to do 144 experiments. 48 different precipitants, each at three different concentrations. So, Carl, we were doing this in collaboration with Jim Berger at Berkeley, who taught us how to crystallize proteins. And we started to interact with him and kind of converge on his design for the device. And so when it was pretty stable, Carl went to Berkeley to do some experiments. And Jim's students were very skeptical of these funny little rubber devices. And in a week and a half, Carl did more experiments than Jim's best postdoc did in a year. And by the end of that visit, they were converts. And it worked really well. We did side-by-side tests with the in-chip crystallization results with benchtop. In-chip tended to work better. We got emboldened, went around to our friends in the structural biology community, said, reach back into your freezer, pull out the most refractory proteins you have that you haven't had much luck with. And so with this a variety of results gotten by us and others using the chips, using material from others. In this row, it's membrane proteins, which are very challenging. Large complexes here, and a variety of other things that were difficult. So as more evidence gathers, it's become clear that you really do win by using free interface diffusion, and you can crystallize things that have failed in all other methods. This chip is now commercially available. It's making its way out in the structural biology community. there's a couple of very good structures that have been done with it. Tim Springer, about 2 years ago, got to cover Nature with an alpha integrin, where he got the first, basically got the crystallization conditions by using the commercial chip. Ian Wilson has a paper coming out in Science where he's crystallized the H5N1 influenza viral protein, again done in the chip. Yeah.
Those are really important proteins, the membrane proteins.
Yeah.
I mean, almost all drugs work on the membrane proteins. Only two human ones crystallized. There's a whole institute in Germany, about 200 people working on the same thing. Can you think now how to use multiphase systems, possibly little pieces of membrane, some way in which you can use this to start to crystallize membrane protein?
Yeah, we're working on it. I don't have a lot to report, but that has not escaped our attention as an interesting thing to go after. And
yeah.
We've been working with Chris Garcia at Stanford.
Yeah.
Seeing this thing.
I think there are 55 membrane proteins, only two are human. The rest of them are bacteria.
Right, exactly. That's that. Yeah, that's right. So we're working on it, but I can't say that we've had any great success with membrane proteins yet. And Tim Springer's off integrin. Is a membrane protein.
Yeah, but not in a membrane.
Great, no. So, do you want to hear why free interface diffusion is useful?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Absolutely.
So let's return to the phase diagram. Precipitant concentration versus protein concentration. So what can you do to try to grow crystals? I mentioned there's a labile and a metastable regime, okay? So sort of heuristically, the labile regime, what happens is you're nucleating very rapidly, nuclei. And that's good because it gives you seeds for crystals, but it's happening too quickly to grow very highly ordered crystals. So that's bad. The metastable regime is metastable, so nothing happens there unless you have a seed. But if you have a seed, you can grow very highly ordered crystals. And so sort of heuristically what you want to do is go here first, get some seeds, and then go here and grow giant highly ordered crystals. What do people actually do? Bearing in mind the fact that you have to do thousands of experiments for any given protein, you can't be too exotic about the technique in some sense. So the simplest technique is called microbatch, where you just mix things together. Just mix them together and see what happens. And so that's equivalent to just picking a point at random and hoping you're somewhere on this boundary where you're going to be able to get a few nuclei and grow highly ordered crystals. That's the easiest thing to do, but also the least successful. What many people like to do is called hanging drop or vapor diffusion, where you sort of have a little hanging drop next to a reservoir of your precipitant, and then as water evaporates from your protein, you're sort of moving up this one protein drop, you're sort of moving up this way, the phase diagram, which is pretty much the wrong way, right? Because you go from metastable and delayed violent to precipitated. But it at least lets you traverse a little bit more of the phase diagram than you could with the microbatch. What happens in free interface diffusion is you take these beautiful curved trajectories like this, okay? And the reason for that, okay, let's say this is your test tube, and there's your interface, and here's your proteins, which are always very high molecular weight, and here's your precipitant, which is always low molecular weight. If you're a little fly on the wall who's sitting right here as the experiment progresses, what do you see when the gate is open and diffusion takes over? You're sitting here. Initially, you see all protein, no precipitant, so you're up there. Precipitant is lower molecular weight, so it starts to diffuse in. So you see an increase in precipitate concentration with very little change in protein concentration. Then on a longer time scale, the protein molecules start to diffuse out. And so you start to see the precipitate concentration leveling off and the protein concentration going down. So it gives you these curved trajectories. This was invented more than 30 years ago. As a concept, and it was very difficult to implement because you couldn't get to this regime of low Grashof number, because as you can imagine, any density-driven convection is going to totally destroy this picture, because you'll have, you know, funny plumes, and as soon as you start to nucleate a crystal of any given size, gravity takes over and it falls to the bottom, and anyways. That's one of the reasons why low Grashof number is really important, and that's why FID is sort of a heuristically favorable algorithm to try to do to grow crystals. It's a good way to control the nucleation growth kinetics. And that's what happens in the chips. And so finally, when you've sort of gotten to a pretty good condition, this chip here to actually get the structures, so you can reproduce the FID experiments and play a few more games with the kinetics if you like, and then punch out a disk from one of these wells, dip it in liquid nitrogen, take it down in the synchrotron, and shoot the crystal right into the disk. So Carl was able to obtain structures from a bunch of model proteins, lysozyme, thaumatin, glucose isomerase, and catalase, using his in-chip data taken at the ALS, Berkeley. The quality of the diffraction data is exceptional. We're in the top 10, and in many cases, the top 5 resolution for that's ever been reported for these proteins. Not that it matters much, because it's already well known and well done, but it lends evidence to the fact that it does help to grow in these low Grashof number conditions in the chip. And all the other metrics, the more technical ones like mosaicity, are sort of off the charts. Just really, really quite good. That came out in JAX a little while ago. Megan Anderson is now going on to actually solve our first novel structure in the group. It's a glucose kinase mutant, glycerol kinase mutant, and she took the data at Slack at SSRL using the in-chip crystals, and actually she grew crystals both in the chip and on the benchtop, and the resolution was significantly higher than the one she showed on the chip. So we're happy about that. There'll be more about it. You guys don't care about glycerol kinase, so I won't get into it. So let me sort of wrap up by talking about a couple of tongue-in-cheek numbers. And what other things scale? So I've talked about how physical properties of fluids scale as you shrink the volume. How about chemical and biological aspects? And so you guys can make fun of me, but I'll define a new number. I'll call it the Darwin number. All right. Darwin number, you can define that as sort of the overall mutation rate of a population divided by the rate of growth. Think bacteria or something like that, or people, I don't know, think about bacteria. Okay? And so if you want to study a particular bacterium where there's strong selection pressure against it, okay, you want your Darwin number to be very, how did I define it? You want it to be small, right? So this thing is growing and going through many generations faster than the population is mutating. Because if there's selection pressure against it, it's going to mutate into something different that you don't want to study. And so it turns out that by making little bioreactors with nanoliter volumes instead of milliliter or liter volumes, your Darwin number can become very small because the mutation rate of the population is going to depend on the size of the population. Right? You would naively say it's some fixed rate times the size of the population is the probability of mutants going to come up. It's not quite that simple, probably, but it does depend in some way on the size of the population. And so by shrinking the volume of your reactor, keeping the concentration of bacteria constant, you get to push this number down. And you can cheat evolution. You can study things that are very unstable in an evolutionary sense. So my student, Frederick Balagad, built such a device. The particular bioreactor he built is called a chemistat, a microchemistat. Chemistat was actually invented by Leo Szilard, physicist. He built this chip, Frederick, that is, built this chip with six chemistat reactors on it. This is a picture of one. The basic idea behind a chemistat is that you're going to be continuously adding new media to a reactor while taking out a defined volume. Chemical engineers all know about this. The way we accomplished it in the chip was to use some plumbing tricks. So the reactor itself is in the shape of a loop with a little pump so you can mix things around. There's some 16 segments here, any single one of which can be isolated from the rest of the reactor, which is shown over here. So now this little segment right here is isolated, and we're flowing the purple stuff through, and the green stuff in the reactor is doing just fine. So this is where you flush out a volume and add a little bit more media, then reconnect to the reactor, circulate again, and there you go. One of the problems with miniaturizing bioreactors is that bacteria, they tend to stick to the walls of your reactor, and that throws off all these simple models of how reactors work. It's a problem, and as smaller your reactor is, the greater the surface area to volume ratio, the worse the problem is, so it may seem like a very foolish thing to try to make miniaturized ideal reactors. We actually dealt with that in this case by, in between the steps of washing out the waste and adding in the food, we put in some solution to scrub the walls. And so by doing different segments and working our way around, you can actually prevent wall growth in these reactors and have sort of an active plumbing scheme.
What do you do with the bacteria while you're doing that?
Sorry?
What do you do with the bacteria while you're doing that?
While we're scrubbing the walls?
Yeah.
Okay, so we've isolated this segment. They were going to be flushed out to waste anyway, so the ones that are in there in that little segment.
Just that segment.
Just that segment. We flush it out. Before we add the new media, we clean the walls, then add the media, and it makes sense. And that's all shown in a little movie here. I hope. So, this is the chip filled with food coloring again. It's going to zoom in a little closer. And the animation will start. So, we'll start with this segment down on the right here. Flush different colors of food dyes through there. So we've taken out the yellow, put in brown, then blue, and then it shuffles around. Then this one will be next, brown, blue, and the blue is mixed. Okay. Okay. And in this way, this is greatly accelerated, but in this way, this thing will grow bugs, and populations of 10,000 bacteria are stable there for more than a week at a time. And without wall growth. And so, the chemistat does what it's supposed to do. This thing sits on an optical microscope. We take pictures of the chambers and then count the bugs in the picture to get an idea of the population. So this shows number of cells per picoliter as a function of time. You inoculate, and then they grow, and then they hit some steady state value where they're dividing, constantly dividing, but the population in the reactor stays the same. That's the genius of the chemistat that Szilard invented. These bugs are undergoing constant growth, and yet their boundary conditions are perfectly well controlled.
They have to be anaerobic bugs, is that right?
No, because we can aerate the reactor, the solutions. And so for different sort of media richnesses and pumping dilution rates, you get different levels of equilibrium to the reactor. It sort of follows the trend it's supposed to. So the thing we were interested in studying, remember I mentioned that this is all in the context of low Darwin numbers and trying to cheat evolution, was we wanted to study a synthetic circuit. Okay, this has become sort of an interesting new area, synthetic biology, where people are trying to use the tools of molecular biology to create logic of the devices within living cells. And so people come up with these very clever ideas. In this case, by our collaborators, Ron Weiss and Francis Arnold, they had an idea to make a population control circuit by taking advantage of a quorum sensing mechanism where the bacteria can sense each other. And so what they did is they E. coli doesn't have this sensing mechanism. They cloned it in from another bug, and they hooked it up to a suicide gene. So the E. coli, they make a little chemical. They can sniff it as well. If they sniff too much of it, that means there's a lot of people around. That's hooked up to a suicide gene, so they start killing themselves. And the idea is that when the circuit is activated, they would have a lower equilibrium concentration than a higher one. Okay. Now the problem is this is a fairly complex set of plasmids to put into bacteria, and this is a general problem with synthetic biology. So it's really unstable. Selection pressure causes the bacteria to mutate after about 60 hours, and that's why their graphs all sort of end in paper around there because the circuit stopped working. And so with the microchemostat, we thought with the low Darwin number, we'd be able to make very careful studies of these sorts of synthetic circuits. And lo and behold, when we put their population control circuit into our chemostat, really interesting things happen. When the circuit is off, the bugs grow to some equilibrium value, just as you expect. When the circuit is turned on, they start to oscillate, okay? And they oscillate coherently. Turns out it's actually pretty difficult to design a biological oscillator. That's one of the sort of first problems people looked at synthetic biology. We happened to stumble across one, and it was coherent as well, purely by chance. So that was pretty neat. And then it turned out, because we were imaging the contents of the reactor, we also noticed that the morphology of the bugs was changing depending on the phase of the oscillation, and that repeated itself all the way through every cycle. So we're, by having this ability to make very careful measurements, we're now able to dissect the circuit in ways that weren't possible before. And that's where Frederick is wrapping up his thesis. Skip that one. As far as slowing evolution, here's an illustration of a circuit that was on for more than 500 hours in the circuit. So really, we've cheated evolution by more than a factor of 10. Okay, the last example is one from chemistry. This is actually not my own work. This is from a company which I'm associated with, so you can take all due skepticism to my statements about it. So how many people know what PCR is? Not everybody? All right. So PCR is how you amplify DNA. That's a very clever idea. So if you have a DNA molecule and you want to amplify it, you design a bunch of little tiny molecules whose sequence are designed to match the beginning and end. Okay, and then you use this enzyme called DNA polymerase, which is a little Xerox machine, and it'll make copies. So you start off by heating the solution, so those guys denature, and you have two molecules. The little ones will stick to the ends, and the DNA polymerase will synthesize your new strands. So now where you had one before, now you've got two, and you repeat this process, and the molecules grow exponentially. So it's very, very powerful and useful. But it's in some sense limited, because what can happen you should in principle be able to amplify single molecules all the time, right? But you can't. It takes a lot of work usually, and the reason for that is all these little molecules here can get into trouble. Okay, they can self-hybridize or they can stick to other stray DNA, and that causes background and it siphons off the reagents and all kinds of issues. So if you define a number, which I'll call mu, or the Mullis number, that's going to be the ratio of template molecules to primer molecules. Okay, so template is the big one that you want to amplify. The primers are these little ones that you need to amplify. You need them to do the amplification. In order for the sort of chemistry of the reaction to work, these primer molecules have to be at a certain concentration, so you can't just kind of dilute them down to nothingness. There's other considerations to worry about. So you can use microfluidics to actually make the Mullis number be rather high. smallest number will be low in microfluidic scenarios. And and that's a good thing because it reduces these parasitic side reactions. And so these guys at Fluidigm kind of figured this all out, and they designed a little chip with chambers. And the chambers are all connected by these blue channels here. So if you have a 10 microliter PCR solution you want to amplify, you flow it into these 1,000 chambers. Each chamber has 10 nanoliter volume. And then the red lines show where valves are used to isolate every chamber. So instead of doing one 10 microliter PCR reaction, you're doing 1,000 10 nanoliter PCR reactions. And each of those PCR reactions is a low Hollis number. And so you know, the effective, if you're trying to amplify from a single molecule, making the volume small is a good thing to do because it reduces the Hollis. Was that clear, that idea? Right? One template molecule, 10 microliters versus 10 nanoliters, you're going to have better connection to the 10 nanometer reactor. Okay, and so it works really well. This is data from their website, you can go see it. So here they've loaded different parts of a chip with different numbers of template molecules per chamber. Okay, and so at 5 molecules per chamber, green is good, needs to be amplified, red is bad, didn't amplify. So almost every chamber is lighting up at 5. At 1 molecule, you're starting to see some of the Poisson statistics take over. At a tenth of a molecule per chamber, it's even lower density, and at no molecules, there's a little glitch there, but very few false positives. Okay. And if you ask, what would you expect to get simply from counting statistics versus what they did measure, because they know what the concentration of what they loaded in, it lays right on. So the efficiency of amplification is very high, and it looks like probably the most precise way to do PCR and digitize things. So in my lab, we've been using these chips, we buy them, to do gene expression from single cells. We're looking at transcription factors, which are expressed by very low numbers. this is an example using Vimus cDNA, about 2 cells worth, in this case, in the chip. This is multiplex looking at 3 different genes. That's the node template control here and here. And you can count the spots here. I'll break it up for 3 different colors. So GAPDH, which is a fairly highly expressed gene in this case, lights up like this, like Christmas tree, the controls. GATA3, which is a transcription factor, now you're starting to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 molecules, and that 10 microliter volume. And again, very significant with respect to the controls. PU1, even a transcription factor that's expressing even lower levels, just a couple of copies per cell. We're able to measure that with respect to the background. So, we've just finished doing, my student Luigi Warren, I should say, has just finished doing a pretty extensive survey of it's actually GAPDH and PU1 in hematopoietic stem cells, and I'm trying to understand the role that PU1 plays in differentiation. So I'll stop there and say that, you know, we've had a lot of fun making these plumbing tools and kind of exploring how to use them for automating biology. And we think they're going to be technologically important. But there's also a lot of really interesting physics to explore there. And I think many fun discoveries to make. Folks in the group who did the work, the droplet work was done by Todd Thorson, who's now in mechanical engineering at MIT on the faculty. I don't have a picture of Alex Reisman here, but he's now at UCSD in physics, who did the fluid logic work. Crystallography is done by Carl Hansen and now by Megan Anderson. The chemistat by Frederick Balagad. And this digital PCR by